Hello and welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I'm your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today is a super cool episode all about the gear of John Bonham, and I am joined by two Bonham experts. I've got Mr. Terry Keating, a.k.a. Bonzolium. Terry, welcome.
Hi there.
And I've got George Flutis, a.k.a. Bonhamology. George, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Yes, you're both return guests. George, you were on, I think I called it the John Bonham episode, which was super popular episode. It was by far my most popular episode. And then Terry, wow. I had you on and I thought, everyone knows this guy from Bonham. We're going to do
and
a different one.
It's my least popular episode.
That one stunk. No, that was, we talked about collecting and that was a really fun
one.
Yeah,
I forgot about that. Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, it was cool time. To get a different, you know, a different side of Terry for that one. But we're going to be talking about John Bonham, Bonzo, his drum sets. We can talk about cymbals, mics, whatever comes up along the way. So let's just jump right in here, guys. And I think, George, we're going to start with you on his pre-Zeppelin drum sets. So what is the first drum set we're going to talk about today?
Well, as far as I know from what I've read, his first drum set may have been a Premier. He was like 15 years old, a teenager with an old rusty kit. I think he described it as mostly rust. But the first kit that I've ever seen photos of, chronologically speaking, was a Trixon kit that looked like it was some sort of pearl finish, like a black pearl or maybe blue. It's a black and white photograph, so you know you can't tell really what the color was, but it looks like it might be a black diamond pearl kit. And it's a Trixon kit, and he's all of about 16 and playing this kit. And they're the only couple photos that I know of, pre-Zeppelin, of him behind a drum set. There are no, it's kind of hard to believe, but there are no other photographs of him sitting at a drum set before Zeppelin.
So, or at least that we've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean that.
I mean that you, some might show
that are out
some
here.
Look, hey, man, look who this is. You know.
Yeah, and when I came across that photo, there's like two photos of him at that time, and he's, you know, wearing like a suit jacket and his hair.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the guys have suits.
Yeah. He's kind of mod looking, you know.
Yeah. It's 64, right? Isn't that when it's from?
I don't know the exact year, but it was with Terry Webb and the Spiders, and so who knows how long he had that kit, but.
Yeah.
By the time he started playing with Zeppelin in 68, we know that he was playing a Slingerland kit. And it was thought that kit was maybe Green Sparkle. Jason Bonham actually confirmed not too long ago that it was a Blue Sparkle kit. 22, 13, 16. And he had a Supraphonic, five-inch Supraphonic snare, an LM400. And you can see some photos of him playing that kit from Zeppelin's earliest tour, which is when they played some dates in Scandinavia in September of 1968. So, you know, the band basically came together that summer, August of 68. There's a recording of Bonzo with Tim Rose that's from sometime in the summer of 68 before he joined Zeppelin. And in that recording, you can hear the drum sound is really similar to the sound of the drums on the first album. So I suspect that this Slingerland kit was his primary kit, you know, in those early days and up to the recording of Zeppelin One. There's talk in books like Thunder of Drums and maybe, you know, some other articles about Bonzo's gear that he had a Ludwig Super Classic, I think, a Green Sparkle kit. There's no evidence of that kit. There's no photographs of it. So if he did have that kit, I don't know of him ever playing it on a studio session without having photos from, you know, the studio sessions for the first album. It's anyone's guess. But my gut feeling is that he was playing the kit that he was playing on those first dates with Zeppelin the month before, which was that Slingerland Blue Sparkle kit. And then you see he has that kit through the end of 68 when they're doing gigs in England. And then at the end of December 68, they came to America for the first time. And so he had a kit that was a Ludwig 22-13 and 216 floor toms, Black Diamond Pearl Ludwig. Now, I don't know if he bought that kit or if that kit was like a backline or it was a rental that he got once he got to the States with the band for their very first tour. But he was only playing that kit from the end of December, last week of December, until the end of January, which is when he gets the maple thermal gloss kit that's iconic, you know, very famous, famously associated with that kit. Now, Carmine Appice is the one who hooked him up with the deal with Ludwig, and that's because they were touring together in January of 69. So he, you know, that Black Diamond Pearl kit, I mean, Terry, maybe you can, you know, chime in here on that. We saw some photos, Terry shared some photos of that kit as it was being prepared for an auction, and it ended up going to the Museum of, what's the name of that museum, MPOP in Seattle?
Robert Plant auctioned it, right? He donated it to the auction.
He donated it, right.
And it was interesting because it was a 22 and it had the telescoping legs, like the big 20, you know, Ludwig used to do those on the bigger drums sort of before they developed the longer legs for the bigger drum. But for whatever reason, on a 22, there it is, two on each side. But this fella sent me an email maybe 4 years ago now?
Yeah, a few years ago.
You saw the ad. It was either online or something. It was one of the auction houses or something. There's Robert Plant standing next to somebody, and there's this five-piece or four-piece kit. Actually, there was a jazz festival with it at the auction, which you can see in the pictures, too, a matching Black Diamond Pearl Keystone badge. And so he sent some good pictures of it. So apparently this fellow who this was, who I think is in England somewhere, is like a known drum cleaner-upper person. You know what I mean? Like an ex-tech for somebody. So he totally like cleaned them up, and then they auctioned them off, or they donated them, or I don't know.
Yeah, I believe they were auctioned, and Paul Allen, right? That's the guy who ran the. That's his museum, the Museum of Popular Music, or whatever it's called. The MPOP.
I've heard of that
in Seattle.
I've seen pictures. So, yeah,
yeah, it was on display there for a while. The kit was set up, and it said John Bonham's first drum kit or something.
Wow!
Now that kit ended up going to the drummer Tony Newman, great drummer who played with. He's on David Bowie's Live album, and I have some photographs of Tony Newman playing that kit, and he talked about in this little article about how he acquired the kit from Bonham. He doesn't say what he did with it, but I'm assuming he must have at some point given it to Robert Plant or sold it to him. I don't know, because the kit was supposedly in Robert Plant's possession, and Robert was the one who had it cleaned up, you know, and prepared for this auction by this drum tech guy or this drum shop in England. Our friend Billy Harrington, I think he knows who that was, the shop in England that did that work. Another interesting thing is the snare drum. I guess it's interesting to us because we're Bonham fanatics, but the snare drum is a chrome Slingerland, like 5.5, like one of those Gene Krupa, you know.
Sound King,
yeah. With like the three lines through it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can clearly see that he's playing a metal Slingerland snare on those early dates in late 68, early 69. And then within a few weeks, he's got the maple thermogloss. And I think the first gig that he played the maple thermogloss kit on is in Boston. That's likely the first gig. Like, it's like
tea
January.
Party?
Yeah, like January 23rd, somewhere in there, 23rd, 24th.
I also want to throw out there, before we kind of move on, just so I don't forget about it, I do want to mention that it's really neat with these photos, how you said with the Slingerland kit, about how you're looking at a black and white picture and you don't know what color that is. Like, it's like, I think it was green. And then, like you said, Jason confirms that it's blue. It's like, that even adds more mystery to this kind of stuff that you...
Yeah.
It's all...
You know, someone had tinted the photos. Those photos are from a Danish, I think, photographer, Jürgen Angel.
Jürgen Angel.
Yeah. You have one of those prints, right, Terry?
I have an actual Jürgen Angel print here. Bottom behind the kit, he's got the mallets. He's like,
Yes. Wow. Right, right, right. And so those photographs, somebody tinted maybe that very one.
Colorized. Made it look like.
Colorized it and made the sparkle green. So I think because it had been online for so long, this colorized photo, people are like, that was a green sparkle Slingerland, you know.
Yeah, but like in some books over the years, they did talk about a green sparkle 22-13-16 that supposedly even some place, which was in England, for hire place, took back, painted it black, rented it. I mean, you heard that story went around for a long time. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that would have been like that would have explained the Ludwig kit, right?
Yeah, right. You know, but there's never no pictures of that, you know. But yeah, but anyway, so back to the thermogloss, which Billy, what did Billy tell us about what three drums he got first?
Is this a quiz?
Yes, to you.
The three drums that he got first, let's see. Did he get a bass drum? Did he get a 13? No. Just the 14 by 12 and the 18.
Yes. Yeah, right. I got one of the bass drums, the 12 by 14 and the 16 by 18, without tone controls. They did not have tone controls.
Right.
That's
right.
What Billy said. But the 9 by 13 and the 16 by 16, he got a little after that, Billy thinks, that he had, as we see.
And the second bass drum.
And the second bass drum.
So maybe he got the second bass drum initially, but just didn't use it, because there's an interesting story, and now two people have now told me, through John Hyde, who's a drummer who played with the band Detective. I don't know if you know about Detective, but they were on Swan Song Records. And John Hyde is from the Boston area, or he, you know, grew up there. And he said when he saw Zeppelin, he could swear Bonham had two bass drums. And
what location would that have been?
At the Tea Party. But it would have either been January of 69 or May, I think, of 69. And he doesn't recall the month. He just said that he was playing two bass drums. Now, at first I thought, well, maybe he just misremembered that, or, you know, because there are a couple photos from the Tea Party gig in January of 69, and he's just playing one bass drum. He doesn't have two bass drums set up. But another person recently, I think it was a YouTube comment, told me that he also saw Bonzo at the Tea Party in January of 69, and that he had two bass drums.
Well, how many shows did they do?
They did two shows. They did an afternoon show and an evening show. So the existing photos are just from one show. So it's very possible that that other show, maybe he tried out the two bass drums. You know, there's this story about how Peter Grant and Jimmy, like, no one liked the two bass drums. And they were like, it's too much, it's overkill, you know, lose it. And when he tried using the two bass drums later in the summer of 69, he pulled the two bass drums back out and set them up. And there's a few gigs where he's using double bass drum.
Yeah, like four or five gigs, right?
And yeah, there's at least five gigs where he was using them in a row in August of 69. July and August. And I think that might be the time when Robert Plant, you know, said he tells a story about how they used to hide Bonzo's other bass drum because they didn't want him to play it. So that would have likely been at that time. You know, he was probably I'm going to try this. I want to try it, you know.
Yeah.
And they're like, hide Bonzo's bass drum quick, you know.
So, too much thunder.
Yeah. Now, one interesting thing, Terry, you can talk about that, is the depth of the bass drums, which, you know, for most people, they assume Bonzo always played a 26 by 14.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, it used to be years ago, before the internet and everything, all we'd have is like books to pour over. And whenever I would look at the Ludwig thermogloss, whenever I would look at the kit, there was only one picture I think I ever saw where it looked from the side like it was 14, like a standard run-of-the-mill 14 by 26. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It always looked deeper. And, you know, sometimes you'd say, like, back in those days, I'd always say 16. But then later on, somebody sent me some pictures of a 16 by 26, so I wasn't sure. So then my theory for a while was that maybe the lugs, for maybe a year or so, Ludwig might have put the lugs as a different spacing. You know what I mean? Like maybe they were, each lug was much closer to the edge, so it made it look, you know. But it just was always, I'd always be like, God, that bass drum, you know. So I'd made videos out of it over the years. George and I, we Zeppelin freaks, would always talk about, you know, just that we'd say 16, but it just, there was just something never sat well with it, you know. So sure enough, this fella, Billy Harrington, who's playing in Chicago tonight in a band, he's on tour, went and met with Paul Thompson, sat out, interviewed him. The interview went into Modern Drummer like two or three years ago. And sure enough, Billy Harrington solved the mystery. They were 15 inches deep. They weren't 14 inches deep. They weren't 16. They were 15. There was a period of time, ironically, that back in the day, Carmine Appice had his specs with Ludwig. He'd switched the bass drum. He wanted his 26s when he ordered them from Ludwig. I don't know, maybe his 24 too. But his 26s, because he said he had a Leedy drum way back in the day that was 15 inches deep. So he always had Ludwig do that. So when he called Ludwig and said, hey, give him, you know, my kit, you know, get Bonham, you know, my kit, they were probably like, oh, yeah, okay, well, 26 by 15. And then gave him these drums, you know.
The fact that he had, you know, a 15 inch deep, I think the fact that Billy was actually there to measure them in person is really, really wild and great. And, you know, Paul Thompson ended up with that kit, but I think Paul Thompson from Roxy Music, he has the kit now. And the tom-tom was cut down. That 14 by 12 tom-tom, the iconic big tom-tom, you know, that was cut down. And I don't know if he cut it down or Colin Fairley. I think Colin Fairley did.
He said Colin Fairley did.
That's the drummer.
He said it came to him like that.
Yeah, right. So Colin Fairley had the kit first. What was the name of the band he was with? The something jug band? String jug band?
Yeah, something like that. Buggy's jug band or something.
Yeah.
Peapod Carrot.
There's even a photo of the kit. There's even a photo of the kit on a single of theirs that we unearthed at some
point. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah,
there's a single, like one of their hit singles, and he's playing Bonham's kit in like 1973 or something.
Yeah.
And I don't remember if the tom was already cut down or it was still Bonham. I think it was still 14
by 12.
I think
it was still big. Yeah, it still looked like Bonham size, I think, in that picture.
It was professionally.
That takes a lot of, I mean, even at that point, you'd think that you would realize the weight of cutting down a drum set like that. I mean, you know, that's John Bonham's drums. You would think you would want to leave them.
Yeah, I mean, but it was early, you know, it was like 1970, 71. I mean, Zeppelin were big, but they weren't, you know, the icons they would become.
That's true.
And I find it interesting that once Bonzo got an endorsement, or at least got that maple thermogloss kit, now he played that kit pretty much from January of 69 through spring of 70. So not that long. You know, really it was just over a year that he played that kit.
Was there a reason he didn't use them for that long, or did he just want to move on to something else? Is that documented anywhere he didn't like the sound?
I don't know. I just know that I think he regretted giving them away. You know, I've heard that he like ran across whoever it was he gave them to, Colin Fairley or something, and I think he sold them for like £5 or something. It was one of those stories, you know. Who knows how true it is, but
yeah, it's like, what do you got in your pocket? Give me
what do you got in your pocket? Exactly. Yeah. And he's like, oh, you know, jeez, I only got £5, and he said, all right. But I from what I've read, he regretted letting them go. He got his first Green Sparkle kit probably in May or June of 1970. So they had finished their U.S. tour in around like March or April of 70. And that was the last time he played that kit.
Before we move on from the maple kit, maybe describe a little bit too about what his cymbal setup would have been on that. Terry, maybe you want to tell us a little bit about that. What kind of cymbals, little hardware? He was a big Swivomatic guy, obviously. So what was he using at that point, cymbal-wise?
Well, yeah, you'd see that I think he loved the Swivomatic hi-hat and those what they call them, the swan leg cymbal stands. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like you'd see him in that one. There's some pictures they unearthed. We're in the studio and Bonham's either taking off or putting on his brand new 602 on the Rogers cymbal stand. But yeah, I think, you know, when you see the pictures from whatever, the Gladsax Teen Club, you know, September, October, 1968, you know, Bonham's on those Slingerlands. and you see the symbols are, I mean, they're Zildjian. You can see, you know, it's a classic Zildjian shape, you know. But I think by the time he got the thermogloss, he, generally speaking, you see he's with 602s. You know, when you see him at like the, there is an interesting thing. It seemed like, in my opinion, I always say to George, and I've talked to people, it seems like he kept one of the Zildjians for a while. It seemed like on his left, sometimes it looked like he used to love having a 16, like in the early days, you know, and then an 18 on his right. But I think it kind of went 16, 18, and then he'd have a 16. And you know, there's sometimes he'd have two symbols on the left, crash, and even two on the right. But I think so. It was generally, I think, Zildjians, then 602s. He kept a Zildjian around for a while, 602s. And then when the giant beads came, he, you know, he got the giant beads, you know, and then went to the 2002s generally after that with the 602 every now and then, keeping a giant bead or two, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really hard to tell because there are no clear photos of those first, from those first few months of his symbols, you know, like shots from above or where you can see the symbols clearly. There is one shot that's a color picture shot from above when they were on Danish TV for like the Danish radio. And, you know, it's called Danmark's BYEN television special. And that Danish TV shot to me clearly looks like the color, you know, like the, how 602s have a certain tone. They're kind of a gold, light gold tone.
Yeah.
It looks like that. They don't look like giant beats. Giant beats are darker. You know, giant beats have a different profile too, but I mean, giant beats have a distinctive color. They're more coppery looking.
Well, plus the bells are bigger in a certain way. You know, they're a larger bell. But also to it, that Danmark's, that's a 16 on his left.
Yeah, he's got maybe a 24, could be a 23. You never know because they made a 23 then.
There was an actual Led Zeppelin document that described Bonham's 602 symbol is 23. Did you find that, George? You and I were talking about that.
I did,
Yeah. It described the symbol as a 23.
It said 23. So he had a 16 on his left and a 18 on his right, and they look bright, you know, gold. So those, to me, that's like, and 14-inch hats. So, you know, Bonham is iconically associated with 2002s. He really didn't play 2002s for that. I mean, he played them, of course, from about 73 onward. But those early days, you know, before they were made, and even after, he was using a giant beat ride for pretty much all of 73 and 75.
I feel like he gets things that become iconic for him are because of, like, one super iconic photo. And then that's what people think he played all the time.
Yeah. He would mix and match, I'm sure. Like, you know, the hi-hats that he was using early on, I think, were 602s, 14s, and then 15s. And then he started using the Sound Edge 602s. I haven't seen any photos of him clearly playing giant beat hats, honestly.
Yeah.
I've done like a pretty thorough investigation.
Now, there was another, symbols. See, whenever I hear George talk about this, I always think of other conversations we've had. Did we ever, you know, George, when you farted around your 602 15-inch hi-hats, or your 15-inch giant beat hats, and you play the intro to Rock and Roll, which sounds more dead on to you?
To me, the giant beats
always do.
Yeah, to me, the giant beats do too, which is funny because at that time live, he was using Sound Edge 602 hats. And he was using giant beat symbols all around, 24, 18, 20, all giant beats.
Yeah.
But the hats were always Sound Edge 15s.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the thing, an original pair of giant beat hats, that's the thing, original giant beat hats, there's some, that they're more in the Zildjian sort of realm in the sense that there's really great sounding pairs, good sounding pairs, and then some that not so much, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and they're also like, quite thin, so they will typically dent very easily, and I would imagine that even if Bonzo liked the sound of them, it would have been like, man, I can't use these live, they just get bent up really quickly, you know, for as hard as he would hit.
So
as far as symbols go, I mean, I think in the earliest days of Zeppelin, likely a mix of maybe Zildjian and maybe even like British companies like Zinn, you know, like Bill Ward from Black Sabbath played Zinn, Ringo had Zinn symbols.
Sure.
But certainly by the time he's got the Thermogloss kit, and they're, you know, well known. He's using Giant Beats or 602s. Okay. Yeah. The Giant Beats came later. The 602s, I think, for most of 69, and then in early 70, there's actually a Peisty document that shows that he was given a bunch of Giant Beats in February of 70.
Yeah, you're more likely to use your awesome new cymbals and not mix and match when you're just, you have an endorser giving you all this stuff. I mean, it makes perfect sense.
Well, that's the thing, too. Remember, Ludwig in America at that time was the Peisty distributor.
Yeah.
So if he got signed up with Carmine, I'm sure it was like, throwing, you know, the sim, you know what I mean?
He was using the 26, 14, 18 setup for several months before he started adding the 16. So I think what happened was when they got through the Chicago area in the middle of 1969, he probably got a bunch of new stuff. He got some little bongos, and I think they might be thermogloss as well. He had a set of bongos.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He also had a 16 now, but you know, and he had a 13, which Billy saw, which we never see, you know, anywhere. But he had a 13x9 Tom. He also got what looks like a whole slew of new 602s because there's some photos from Chicago.
From the Kinetic Playground. The cymbals are like right out of the bag.
You can see fingerprints on them.
Yeah, you know, they're like 602s right out of the bag.
So what I would love to know is, did Bonzo go to the Ludwig factory here on Damon Avenue?
So I heard he did. Somebody said he actually did.
Really? Like somebody took him over there? That would be really cool to know.
A picture of that. Oh, my God.
Yeah, as a kid, I went in that factory because a friend of mine in high school, his father was a woodshop foreman.
Oh, man.
I used to get discounts on some bits like sticks and drum cases.
Yeah.
You know, George is wheeling timpani out the back.
Yeah. I never got that. Yeah. Didn't get that.
Of all the things to steal, a timpani might be the hardest.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So then for the sake of time, moving on to the Green Sparkle kit. Yes. Man, I love personally, I don't know if it's because I saw this kit when I was younger, but something about Green Sparkle is just awesome. I love it. I like Blue Sparkle. I have a Blue Sparkle snare behind me, but it's like Green Sparkle is just something special about it.
It's got kind of a holiday vibe, you know, it makes you happy just to see it.
It does.
There's also like two different sorts. There's the more Kelly Green Sparkle, the older days, and then there's sort of the 1969, 70, 71.
The teeting green.
Yeah, kind of a more of a blue, minty green. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What's your preference?
I kind of like the older. Do you remember anybody familiar with Currency? Back in the older days, the lighter green part of Currency used to be more of a Kelly green versus the blue green. And it was sort of the same with Sparkle wraps, too. It was just more like a Kelly green, you know what I mean? Like almost like the wall behind you. But then, Ludwig and some of the companies. Actually, I think Slingerland stayed with that shade a little. Anyway.
I am familiar with Currency, but not that closely.
I got all kinds of it here.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the Green Sparkle kit.
You know, like I said, he got that kit while they were recording the third album. So I don't know if some of the third album was on the thermogloss kit and some of it was on the Green Sparkle, or it was all with the thermogloss and then he got the Green Sparkle. I don't know. There's no way to know that either without seeing session photos. But what I do know is the first time that kit was used was in Reykjavik, Iceland. And it was sort of a warm-up gig. They hadn't played live since I think April, and they were recording the album, the third album. And they had a big concert at the Bath Festival, the Bath Blues and, folk music festival, which is a massive festival. And as a preparation for that gig, they did this warm-up in Reykjavik. And that was the first time you see Bonham playing the Green Sparkle kit. In fact, the tom was not mounted to the bass drum yet, so he's got it on a snare stand.
Yeah.
If you see the photos from that gig, you can see there's a spare 6.5 Supraphonic behind the drums, you know, off to the side. And then by the time they play Bath, I believe the tom is mounted on the rail. But there's some new footage of that has just recently surfaced, which is really awesome. It's silent footage, but it's really great footage to see Bonzo's brand spanking new Green Sparkle kit in like very good quality because it was professionally shot. But then
What are we talking about? Where's that footage?
The Bath Festival.
Oh yeah, right.
Yeah, there's some brand new footage that just came. Yeah. That just was released, like 8 minutes or so.
This episode is brought to you by Sweetwater. Sweetwater sent me one of the brand new Roland SPD SX Pro sampling pads to play with, and it is amazing. Snare rolls sound natural, cymbals respond to every nuance of your playing, and percussion sounds have a lifelike feel to them you won't get anywhere else. Whether you're flying solo, complementing a full drum kit with a hybrid kit, or integrating with an array of other devices, the SPD SX Pro is a great choice. It features 200 kit patches and more than 1,500 preloaded sounds, and it has a very vivid 4.3-inch full-color display. Multicolor LEDs surround the pads, which are fully customizable, so you can just set a color to each specific thing you want, like a click or a certain sample, like a snare, and then no more marking things with tape, basically. Check it out at the link in the description of this episode, and you can see the Drum History gear page on Sweetwater, and see the SPD SX Pro by Roland, and a bunch of other cool gear there. So, thanks to Sweetwater. This episode is brought to you by Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full-line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee. Call 615-383-8343 or go online at forksdrumcloset.com. Well, the whole thing now, there's a lot of footage because there was footage at the Forum in LA that came out recently, right? That was discovered in Cincinnati, as far as I'm aware. So it's kind of crazy that Led Zeppelin, you know, has not been a band for a long time, and this stuff is coming. It keeps you guys going.
Yeah.
It keeps you guys on your toes.
Yes, it is nice to see. It is nice to when that stuff comes up.
There are fans out there, some of whom I know. They're great guys, young guys who are really, they're like history sleuths, you know, when it comes to Zeppelin. They leave no stone unturned. So you know, they're just putting feelers out through social media and stuff, and people come up and just say, hey, my dad saw Led Zeppelin, he was a huge fan, he saw him in 1969 and he's got some real to real tapes, I don't know, they've been in our closet since I was a kid, you know.
Yes.
And so that kind of thing is still happening. Totally. Terry, I wanted to give this one to Terry because I'm not really sure how many Green Sparkle kits there were. I don't think anyone is really sure, but Jason is the guy, obviously, to talk to.
Well, that's the thing. You know, honestly, Bart, you got to try and get Jason. Don't mention don't get George and I mentioned, because he might be like, are you the guy that interviewed these two freaking guys? The thing is there's stories of Bonham, of Zeppelin being at Headley Grange, which is the house they used to rent in England. Mm-hmm. You know, them being there, and then Bonham took delivery of a new kit, they said. And they set
that's
it up.
It might get loud.
Yeah.
Jimmy Page says that, and it might get loud.
So he talks about, it's implied, it's stated that there's one kit there that they've been recording with, and there's another one comes that the roadies set up in the stairwell, which is where they recorded the drums for, you know, the When the Levee Breaks, and I think Misty Mountain Hop. I think they tracked Misty Mountain Hop.
Definitely.
Too.
You know absolutely. What I mean? It's the same sound.
It's the same exact same.
It's the
sound.
Same.
It just
sound.
Doesn't have, you know, there's not really the Benson or whatever on it, but they sound
also,
the same.
And that's December of 70, January 71.
Yeah, right.
So he clearly had a Green Sparkle kit as of June of 70. So
well,
he
exactly.
may have gotten a second kit.
That's exactly
know.
So that's where I'm getting with. I think at least there might have been two, right? Two Green Sparkle.
I would think there was two. There was a spare, definitely a spare bass drum. You can see photos of a spare Green Sparkle bass drum off behind the stage or behind the setup.
Well, it's funny. There was a collector that I got to meet and talk to about almost 30 years ago now who sent me a video of, I had the video up on YouTube for a while, the Amber drums. You know, it's, you know, the consensus now mostly is that the drums he actually had that he purported to be Bonhams, I think, were not genuine. Mm-hmm. But he did have information that what he had always relayed to me, he said that there were three Green Sparkle kits.
And I think that might be what Jason said, but don't quote me on it. I just recall reading that somewhere, and I thought maybe Jason was the one who said one is with the family at the old Hyde Farm still, and another one is it at a museum somewhere, Terry?
Something like that, you know. And then, but also too, that he also said that one of the bass drums was, and he got the drum set, one of the incarnations of the Green Sparkle was two bass drums, a 9x13, a 10x14, a 12x14, and the 16x16, the 16x18. You know what I mean? Like, he supposedly had a 12x14 Green Sparkle Tom that is never been pictured with. There was supposedly a 9x13. But by those times too, you know, you always hear, you know, there did come a time where bands got so good at touring and stuff, or, you know, like, so they'd be like, all right, well, let's keep one of these kits with Shoko in the States. We'll keep the other one in London for when we had and we record, and we'll keep the other one somewhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, my question on that, though, would be like, was he, like, if you're going to have three Green Sparkle kits, he was clearly really connected to the Green Sparkle look. Instead of like going, oh, I'm going to get one Green Sparkle, one Red Sparkle, one Blue Sparkle.
Right.
You know what I mean? Was there a reason he wanted to get three identical kits?
Here's the thing.
I don't know.
I know having a backup bass drum makes perfect sense because you know, bust a bass drum head on the gig and which there's actually, you know, it happened, and there's audio recording of it where you can hear clearly his bass drum breaks. But and Robert Plant says something like, you'll have to excuse us while we change the bass drum skin. So I don't know if they had the backup there, but
very when descriptive.
When they played in Milan in 1971, there was a riot at the stadium, and the police sort of exacerbated everything by tossing some tear gas canisters out and all.
Stop lighting those fires! Can you stop lighting those fires? That's what Robert Plant was told to keep saying.
Yeah, and it's just all hell broke loose. People rushed the stage. The band had to escape for their lives, you know.
Yeah, seriously.
And run for their lives, you know, and the equipment got trashed. And you can see photos, there's photos of the aftermath, and Bonzo's drums are strewn all over the place, and you can see, like, one of the floor tom legs is, like, all twisted up. And so what's interesting is there's a photo of Bonzo's kit from behind where you can see the floor toms clearly from behind, and one of the mounts, the leg is like this on an angle. It's not straight. So that would tell me that maybe that was the floor tom that got damaged in the riot, and they had to screw the hole, drill a new hole so it could, you know.
Sure.
Wow.
Yeah.
So in that photograph, he has a clear head on the back of the bass drum. On the batter side. You can clearly see through the bass drum, and you can see the three circles. And you can see that the mystery ring, which Terry and I have been, you know, racking our brains trying to figure out what kind of muffling that was on his front bass drum head.
Yeah, specifically, because it's either a ring or it's a disc, or we have the new theory. Remember, we were just talking. Sorry, George.
That's right. Yeah. So I brought this up on social media recently because I wanted to just put it out there and get some feedback. But if you look at the front of Bonzo's bass drum with the Thermagloss kit and with the Green Sparkle kit, there is some sort of ring going around the perimeter. It is not a, you know, like a power stroke as you would conventionally think of one, because a power stroke makes a particular image or, you know, like shadow or pattern. Do you know what I mean? Where it looks a little bit darker in the center, and it looks white around the ring. Bonzo's is the opposite. Bonzo's looks darker around the perimeter and bright white in the center. So I thought, you know, the explanation for that is it's the opposite of a ring. It's a disc. that's like a 20-inch disc cut out and glued to the head. But then I thought, that doesn't make sense. Why cut it smaller? Why not just double the thickness? Exactly. But at that time, there were it was a thing to make a ring, and they called it a Richie ring. What was that guy's name, Terry? Richie, the drummer?
Richie Ringman. He was American.
Born for it.
No, but, that's what they used to do. They just sometimes people would take styrofoam and put it on the edge, they'd use pieces of. But you know, and this is funny though, because there was a fella that was contacting me. He saw one of George's my videos about the possible muffling system, or the which was definitely there. You can see on all the drum kits this sort of what appears to be a ring, or different color on the edge, pretty very distinct. People will always say, no, man, that's a shadow. And you're like, it's not a shadow. We're freaks.
No way.
What it is. What I think now, kind of what I think it is, thanks to this fella showed me a couple drums that he got, the marching drums. And inside the marching drums, I think what a lot of people used to do in marching days is they just real quick with a can of either spray paint or something, and they just go like, and they kind of just put paint like here, just to slightly deaden the drum. And I think what conceivably could be with the bottom thing is you have the head, you take the Richie ring, set it there, take spray paint and go, pull the ring off, flip it over, it'll be whiter here and it'll be darker here. You know what I mean? So that's what I'm starting to suspect, I think. But you see it on the Vistalite, which is not a white head, you know?
I'm not convinced on that, but I will say this. In those days, Terry, do you remember Rough Coat? It was an aerosol spray to rejuvenate drum heads.
No.
Ruffkote. And Remo bought their patent and shut it down because they were – my dad used to buy it. I remember the cans.
Was it a hyper-cancerous thing that used to melt the head a little bit and then reset it?
No, it was a.
It probably was cancerous, but
yeah, well, maybe a little.
Everything
cancerous.
Is, yeah.
No, but
yeah.
But that wasn't the reason for it being phased out. The reason it was phased out, obviously, was caught putting a big dent in Remo's sales because people would wear out the front of the head or the top of the head, and then he'd be like, "Oh, I'll just spray it with Rough Coat," and it was literally like the same coating. It was a granular, kind of gritty. White spray paint.
Oh, for like an ambassador, an emperor, like a coat.
Yes.
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah, that could be.
It was
a
spray coat. So it could have been that, that's another possibility. Because Rough Coat existed in the 70s. Although I don't know if it existed as far back as 70. Yeah. And Bonzo had something going on. I don't think I've ever seen a bass drum with that same look on the resonance.
That's the thing. I have never.
That's interesting.
I mean, there must be with drummers like other way, people might say, put the easy way, put a rug in there or whatever. Or, people, I don't like the way that looks or whatever. Yeah. Putting this ring, maybe it was just something locally big. Like if you look at other pictures of freaking Birmingham bands, man, you might seem to see a couple other bands.
Maybe.
Interesting. Yeah. Maybe. Drummers are innovative. And I mean, what it sounds like is like you said, adding some thickness to it with spray paint or almost like a homemade, there's also like a homemade big fat snare drum kind of thing where you cut out an old head and put it on there and it's like a little, just to
that's
layer it
the
up.
Richie, that's the Richie. That's the Richie. Thing. And that was being done a long time ago. So another thing Bonham did to muffle his bass drum, I think, and John Paul Jones says it, at one point, he put crumpled newspaper in the bottom.
My grandpa would talk about that.
Yeah, that was a common thing like back in the day. And so you can see photos. There's photos of Bonzo's maple thermogloss kit before he has this ring type muffling resonant head. Before that point, you can see there's something in the bottom of the bass drum. And you can see it from the front. And you can see it from behind, the footage from the French TV show footage. You can see there's something crumpled up in there. And John Paul Jones said he used crumpled newspaper. Other people have said he lined the bass drum with tin foil.
Yeah, remember that one. That was a big one back in the 70s. He lined it. Was it aluminum? Was it sheet aluminum?
Was it Reynolds brand or Saran?
You're right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that would be like the opposite, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that make it more reflective and louder?
Exactly. Loud. It would add a lot of like you know, punch.
Punch,
and,
yeah.
And high frequency. But
what about felt strips? I mean, you see a lot of felt strips in photos of, like, recreation kits and things like that. Was he a big felt strip guy?
He almost always used a felt strip at the bottom of the, sure. the
batter. On the batter, on the beater head. Yeah, he usually at the bottom, just about maybe, you know, a sixth of the way up the head or whatever. Fifth.
Got it.
And I would love to know from Jason someday. But, you know, maybe that's one of those mysteries that needs to be there. You know, and who knows? Maybe Jason feels like, man, I'm not going to give away all my dad's secrets, you know?
Yeah.
But the secret is obviously in his playing. You know, all the gear stuff is fun and it's interesting, but Bonzo could play any kit and sound like himself.
Freaking Bonzo, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the touch, it's in the hands. You know, that's the main ingredient. You know, as far as like chasing his sound, three-ply, Ludwig, big drums, that's going to get you there sooner. But I guess, you know, moving on from the Green Sparkle kit, he used that kit until the end of the European tour in 1973. So basically he used it all up through 71. He used it longer than he used
pretty much any other kit.
Pretty much any other kit. By all accounts, I guess he really loved it. He loved to record. That was like a preferred kit to record with even later.
Yeah.
You know, like when he was recording Physical Graffiti, he had the Vistalite kit. So the Vistalite kit surfaces at the beginning of May 1973. So in April is the end of the Green Sparkles live, and then May of 73 when they opened in the U.S. in Tampa. You know, you see the brand new Amber Vistalite kit.
Yeah, right.
Which, talk about iconic. And let me throw this one to Terry, question to Terry here. You think of Vistalites, you think of Bonham. Really, you think of Amber Vistalite, you think of him. Is this just anyone could pick this color at that point out of a catalog?
I think so. I think what happened was, is with Ludwig, I heard Ludwig had a lot of faith in the Vistalite. They put a lot of Slingerland, like a lot of the companies really thought Vistalite were going to be like the way to go.
Yeah.
Terry, what year did they first come out? What was the first production year?
I know definitely by 72, because there were, you know, I wish I just had stuff to back up. But, you know, so Bonham, you know, he probably looked at the colors available and was probably, oh, the orange one looks pretty cool. You know, it is pretty interesting because Amber, when you look at it, it is, I mean, probably just because of the Bonham skew, you know, we just love him so much that the Amber, of course, when you see
it looks like fire on the stage.
Yeah, right. It looks just cool as hell.
It really literally looks like, you know, flames.
Quite possibly maybe one of the most iconic drum sets in the world, where you see it and you go, that's John Bonham. You know?
Distinctive. It's very distinctive. And so there's a lot of speculation about that kit, too, and how many there were. I'm assuming there were at least two bass drums. I don't know if there was, you know, more toms. I don't know if there was ever a 20. There's the rumor that he played a 20 sometimes and he had the 20 at Madison Square Garden. No way. That's a 16 and an 18.
Yeah, we've never,
It's either like, you know, like wishful thinking and eyesight or... Or it's optical illusion because of the angle of the photo of the camera.
Yeah.
You know, cameras can play tricks. You know, sometimes something in the foreground can look twice as big as it actually is. So if it's shot from that side of the floor toms, it's like, like Earl's Court, for example, 1975, there are shots of Bonham from off to his right. And those toms look really big, the two floor toms. But when you see the aerial shots in the actual video,
run of the mill, it's just, 16, 18.
It's a 16 and an 18.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
I've never seen. So anyone who says, no way, he used a 20 inch floor tom and you can see.
Or 22. You'll hear people say a 22.
I've heard people say a 22. It's like, man, no way. No.
Well, but you know, the thing is
that they have owned one, but.
But a 20, you know, a Ludwig 20-inch bass drum is also 2 inches deeper. So it should be easier to identify in the, you know what I mean? Because a 16-inch floor tom and an 18-inch floor tom, pretty much by all companies in the sonar stuff, are 16 inches deep. But you get to the 20, you get 18.
And you never see the big floor tom deeper than the 16.
Yeah, because we've looked. I've been like, well, you know, and I've never seen it. You know, it's interesting too, because they keep the extra bass drum, especially Bonham with the rail. They'd have the rack tom on there too, because if he broke the rack tom head, they'd also pick the whole thing up and set the whole thing down. That's what I don't know if it was Townsend or somebody told me that by the time they did the green sparkle. You know,
I mean, it's easier and quicker.
They leave the tom on too.
Did he break? I mean, this is, I feel like this is kind of a dumb question because, you know, like something a non-drummer would ask, but did he break a lot of heads? I mean, was he's such a heavy hitter, and it's pretty early in the, you know, the life of synthetic drum heads, 57 or whatever. We're relatively close to the invention. Was he breaking heads a lot and getting them switched out?
There is that quote from him where he's talking about his drums. And he talks about a snare drum, and he says, well, that snare drum there, that head's been on there for three tours. So, that could mean, remember, 1969, they did six tours. They did four of the states. They did, you know, a tour could be 3 weeks, or a tour could be, he could have been referring to, you know.
You can see they're pretty worn, worn in a lot of photos. The head looks really worn in.
Yeah.
And I know that he said he prefers when the head is worn in, not brand new heads. But of course, when he got the black dots, the Vistalite kit came equipped with black dot heads. So those are much more durable. Pretty hard to break a black dot head. I also think that Bonham's technique changed. You know, he used to bring his arms up really high and hit with more arm very early on. And then he started to refine that, and he talks about it in an interview where he talks about how he was able to control with his wrist motion to get more power out of a stroke with a snap of his wrist. It's sort of like the one-inch punch, theory of Bruce Lee, you know, where you create a lot of momentum with a jab.
An amplification. That. I mean, if they're playing in huge venues, he doesn't need to hit as hard and project as much because it's mic'd up and things are getting better for, you know, the sound guys are better and all
early
that stuff.
Early on, so. Sometimes the drums weren't even mic'd.
Yeah, exactly.
And if they were mic'd, they might have one mic overhead and one in front of the bass drum.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, you can see in The Song Remains the Same, for example, there's a lot of footage of him playing like this. He's not going like this all the time. I mean, for certain accents, yes, for certain dramatic, moments. The Vistalites, he obviously liked the fact that they were loud and they were articulate, you know, that they had a really kind of a cutting sound that could cut through the amplification more. Yeah. I mean, I've never owned a Vistalite kit. Terry, you've owned them. You could probably talk more about, you know, that the way you tune them and everything.
Well, it's like I've never put, you know, coated ambassadors or coated emperors on them. I'd love to. At some point I should, just to see. But when you put the black dots on and on the bottom, you know, you have clear ambassadors or clear whatever. You know, the thing is you get from the Vistalites is it's two things. It's like a bark, but it's also like a bing. Like bing, bing, bing. And the funny thing is the way it's sort of, when you hear it by itself playing, you're kind of like, it's just a very distinct sort of thud. But the funny thing is to me, I actually prefer the sound of Zeppelin in a certain way with the sound of the Vistalites live. There's just a certain mojo to the Vistalites, you know? Especially when you hear like Moby Dick, in parts of Dazed and Confused where Bonham does these little patterns, it's hard to tell sometimes what tom he's hitting. The bass drum's a little easier to identify, but you know, like when you hear like that, the cool Moby Dick stuff he's playing, you don't really see any footage. You know, people for years were like, you know, what the hell is Bonham playing there? What is the pattern he's doing? Are the double strokes with both hands or with just the right hand?
Right. You know? Because the bass drum and the floor toms actually share a lot of common type sound. Especially the 18, like when he does that thing in Dazed and Confused where he plays that paradiddle pattern, and he goes, you know, those last couple notes, it's hard to tell if there's a double stroke on the bass drum or if it's on the floor tom. And when you watch the film, when you look at what he's playing two strokes on the floor tom and ending with the bass drum. It sounds almost like a double stroke on the foot. The Vista Lights have this really like
homogeny. They have a homogenous sound, uniformity, right. which is neat. I mean, it's interesting. Like when you listen to Zeppelin with that, like, you know, it's funny. Like when you listen, like when the 72 stuff came out, what was it, like 20 years ago? How the West was won. You know, it was cool. And so, like in a lot of the songs where you really don't hear the toms, you know, there's that sound. I wasn't really a fan of sort of the How the West. Hang on. I prefer the original Song Remains the Same drum sound to the sort of the How the West Was Won drum sound, but also to the How the West Was Won is the Green Sparkle Wood kit, you know, or at least the, you know, the stuff from 72. That, in fact, that's all it is, right? Isn't it all 72 on How the West Was Won?
Yes.
So that's all the, so when you hear like Moby Dick, or you hear that stuff in Days Confused, or a whole lot of lovers doing these little like tribal patterns, you're definitely like, oh, there's a floor tom. There's a, you know, it doesn't have that same sort of neat sort of just total all around like jugga 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 jugga. You kind of hear more like bing ba boom 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 boom. You know. So the Vistas are, you know, but they are interesting. In fact, I'm going to loan him to George, and George is about to do, he's about to undertake on something that involves the orange Vistalites, the amber Vistalites. We'll just leave it at that.
That's awesome.
I probably wouldn't buy a kit, but I would gladly borrow Terry's. I like playing. I love the sound of them, actually. I wasn't a fan of them years ago, but then I played some at Drugan's Drum Shop here in the Chicago area. There they are.
Yeah.
And it was it was one of those RCI. Is that it, Terry? RCI?
Yeah, Romano Cotone International.
Yeah, it was an RCI replica kit. And it was beautiful. They sounded great. They felt great to play. They're a real responsive feeling.
Yeah.
You know, like they have a really nice rebound.
Are a lot of his drums, you know, do they still exist? Have they been sold at auction? I know you said Jason still has a lot with the family. People have cut them down and stuff like that. But what about his, like, is there an existing amber Vistalite kit anywhere, you know, fully put together that's John Bonham's drum set?
Not that we know.
You want to answer that? Not that I know of.
Well, again, there was a fellow down in South Carolina, or North Carolina, I can't remember, who had a kit. And he sent me some video of it. I talked to him for a while. It was widely sort of, like half the people in the Zeppelin drum community said it was original. The other half were kind of like, no. In any case, I took the video down. Or I think I say, well, this is, I really say this has been disproven to be his kit or whatever. Sure. But, you know, I don't know. There was a kit that Pat Bonham, John Bonham's widow, sold at auction back, I think, in 93 or 4 or 5. And this was supposedly the kit that this fella had bought in North Carolina. Like, if you look in books, it says his name's Bill Townsend. It says his name, you know?
There was an amber kit that was auctioned by the family?
Yes. Yeah, that is for sure. You can see it. And it's so funny. In the picture, they're not set up right. You know, the tom-toms, the floor toms are like, two of the legs are real. You know, they're kind of like.
Yeah. A non-drummer set it up or something.
Totally.
Yeah. I really don't know. I mean, I'm assuming Jason has a kit, you know, or the family has a kit. Yeah. You never know. Jimmy Page might have a kit that you know, was one of the touring kits. So last year, one of Bonzo's kits was being auctioned. The kit that was auctioned was basically like a bebop sized 18-12-14 with a Vistalite snare. And you can see Bonham playing this kit. You can see Jason playing it, and the song remains the same. I think it was a kit that he had probably special ordered for Jason.
Yeah.
Although he, you know, certainly was playing it. You see a video of him where he's playing along with a Tina Turner tune. And he sits down and Jason's got like the clapboard.
Yeah. You know,
and he's he's got a little rubber nose on and he's clowning around going like this. And Bonzo's sitting there just playing along, on this little,
it's a very simple beat,
you know, and he's just grooving along. I actually bid on that kit. I was, I was foolishly hopeful that I would win the auction, and I just, you know, just be honest. I set my cap, so it was like at 11,000, and then it went up to like 15, and then it just sat there for a while pre-auction. So the day of the auction, I'm thinking, I don't know, 15 grand, you know, if it goes for like 20, I might be able to swing it.
Come to mama.
So when that item actually went live, you know, and started ticking up,
yeah,
I maxed out at about 27,000.
Like, wow.
And you know, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. It's like, I can't really afford to spend 20 grand on a kit, let alone 25 or 30.
What did it end up going for?
It went for about, I think, around 90,000.
Wow.
But jeez, then there's a 20-something percent commission. Then there's the shipping charge. And then there's British via the tax.
Oh, yeah.
So when it's said and done, man, you're talking like well over $100,000 that kit sold for.
Man.
So, you know, just a little interesting aside. You know, he had other drums. So we're talking about Bonzo's kits. He had a black swirl Vistalite kit and quite a few drums. He had concert toms. He also had double-sided, like a 26, just like the Green Sparkle sizes or the Amber Vistalites, but in the, I can't remember the name of the pattern. You know, it's a like swirl pattern.
C or something.
Yeah, it's like black. It's like black and white.
Mick Fleetwood owned one of the kits and had it auctioned it off.
Mick Fleetwood ended up with that kit. I think it was the big one, the one with the 26. But this other kit had like a couple bass drums. It had like, it looked almost like a 20 or 22. And you could see pictures of, I'll send you these photographs of him playing the kit at home, and he's got Zildjian cymbals. It's got a Zildjian crash here and Zildjian hats.
Hmm.
And he's got the black swirl set up with a couple extra toms. And then behind him, you can see another bass drum and some toms stacked up.
Yeah, yeah.
In that finish. So I have a theory that Bonzo's Montreux was recorded with multiple toms, not just his conventional setup. So at the time Bonzo's Montreux was recorded, he would have been playing, likely would have been playing the Amber Vistalite kit.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's something about it. You can hear different tones. You don't just hear one tom tone and two floor tom tones. You definitely hear at least two high tom tones. So what was he playing? He could have been playing his new black swirl Vistalite kit. He could have been playing the Ambers but had a 13 along with the 14.
I mean, he's a drummer, though. He likes to play. Who doesn't? And the fact that they didn't take pictures every 5 minutes,
right.
Of course. He has home kits. He has studio
kits. I mean, ultimately, he could have had anything. You know, he could have had, you know, maybe, I don't know, some band was going. Because they were in, weren't they in Montreux? Weren't they in the studio? Didn't he record that at the studio?
Yeah, the Casino Studio?
Yeah, I think so.
Did or what? No, Mountain Studios. It was a studio, studio that Queen had.
Yeah.
That was Queen's studio.
Yeah.
So anyway, so the Amber Vistalites, he played those throughout 73, all of 75, and the last time he played those live would have been at Earl's Court in May of 75.
Yeah.
Hmm. Just time for something new. He just
time for
to switch.
Something new, I guess. And guess what was new then with Ludwig? Stainless steel. So Bonzo, in some ways, he was kind of cutting edge. You know, he was there at the beginning of Vistalite, and then he got a stainless steel kit. You know, I think he he's thought of as like this kind of conservative or traditional, you know, drummer, the one up, two down setup, big band kind of setup and that. But he was always kind of experimenting with things, you know, the use of timpani, having a gong, you know, the drum orchestra thing for Bonzo's Montreux is pretty inventive. Oh, yeah. That's your favorite part, right? That's actually not a drum, by the way. That's Jimmy Page messing around with some synthesized effect. Some people think that's steel drums, but it's not steel drums.
Oh, I got to tell you, it drives me berserker. I wish we could just get the drums.
Oh, yeah. I would love to hear that.
Have somebody else put some other, like a symphony over
I'd love to hear outtakes of that, like the different dubbed parts.
Oh, yeah.
I also think My personal opinion is he was playing double bass drum on that.
Yeah.
At least for certain parts. I think a lot of hardcore Bonhamites don't agree. They think, oh, no, he could play anything with his right foot. Of course, he could play that, but there's a certain aspect to the feel that doesn't double bass sound like one foot playing that pattern. It has more of a swung, almost like
like a lull. You did a great job in your video where you did it with one foot.
I think it's possible, of course, to do. You know, it just to me doesn't sound like it.
Right.
And there's also another important thing is there's no precedent for it. Bonzo never played that particular thing before.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? That it's not like the bass drum triplets. Yeah, he never played uninterrupted 16th notes in a row like that. That's going on underneath everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So anyway, the jury's out on what drum kit he used for Bonzo's Montreux. Who knows?
Sure.
But the Ambers, he was done with that. And then they had some time off. And then the next big tour was 77. And that's, you know, they had recorded the album Presence. Now, Jason Bonham, I remember seeing a comment he made somewhere because somebody had made this comment about the Silver Sparkle. So this goes to the allegations of Bonham having a Silver Sparkle kit. There's no proof for that. So I know some online sources say that was one of his kits, but there needs to be proof if you're going to make that claim. There's no proof of that kit existing.
Well, you know, there's an
interesting... And that it was used on Presence. So, Terry, I'll let you pick it up from there.
Well, the reason why I say is Bill Townsend, this name comes up again, said that on Presence there was a Silver Sparkle kit. He said that Bonham at some point got a Silver Sparkle kit. And he also referred to at the time, this was before a higher definition picture came out of Bonham's drum set up at Polar Studios in 1978 when they're recording, where Bill Townsend mistook the stainless steel drums in the photograph for Silver Sparkle because he probably had a lower resolution picture back in 1992, you know? And, apart from that, I'd said it in videos that's what Bill Townsend had said. Bill Townsend also said, just real fast, just to get this all out, that Bonham supposedly was going to get a black sparkle kit for the 1980 tour, a 24, 13, 16, 18. Again, that's what he said. I've said that in videos over the years. But then what's interesting, though, is I don't think black sparkle is offered in 1980, though. I know Slingerland had black sparkle in 80, but I don't think Ludwig did at the time.
Yeah. I mean, he could probably get what he wanted, though.
Yeah, right.
He could. I just think a lot of that stuff's wild goose chase. I prefer to focus on the stuff we know.
Exactly.
Because it gets to be such a rabbit hole with speculation. And I know most of this is just because people who are really into a particular artist, they get into their gear. You know, it's just natural. I mean, ultimately, none of it matters when it comes to the actual musicality of the artist.
Right.
I shouldn't say none of it, but it's a very small part.
It's the icing on the cake.
It's more fun.
Where's the Amber Bisside?
It's fun. Exactly. That's the point is it's fun. But for me, it's not fun to speculate about, you know, there was a Silver Sparkle kid. He did this. He did that without having some proof. What's more fun for me is making it like when Jason corrected something about the Silver. He said, my dad played the Green Sparkle kit in Munich when they recorded Presence. I know I was there. So he was, you know, Jason's the same age as me. I think he's born in 66. Yeah. So they recorded that album in, fall of 75?
Yeah.
I believe.
That's old enough to remember. I mean,
So if he was 8 or 9 years old, he would remember. Grader,
you know what I mean?
Sure.
I
remember, you know, things from when I was 9. So if he said the Green Sparkle kit was there, I believe it. Yeah. However, later, so in 76, they start rehearsing in very late 76, early 77 for their biggest tour ever. The biggest tour they ever did was the 77 tour. And Bonzo gets this iconic, equally iconic stainless steel kit, which was kind of a novel thing at the time. 26 by 14, 15 by 12 tom, 16, 16, 18, 16 floor tom. And they're rehearsing at the Manticore Studios in London. And they have like a big sound stage, and there's photos from the rehearsals, and you can see, you know, the new kit set up. And I couldn't help but wonder, like, what if he got the kit a little earlier and recorded Bonzo's Montreux with it?
Yeah,
but
yeah, we'll never know that. That's possible.
That's possible too. Yeah. But that was the last kit that he had and used for the remainder of his career. So from 77 to July of 80, which, you know, wasn't very long.
No. And as we're kind of talking about this, we kind of skipped over it a little bit, but I'm assuming his cymbal style and setup, and he had the gong that stayed relatively consistent throughout.
Well, I think that the gong in the earlier days, the gong, I think might've been like 30 or 32, but I think by the time, you know, 73, 75, 77, 80 rolled around, I think it was a 38 inch gong, right?
Wow.
Oh yeah, it was a large one. Yeah. The cymbals, you know, he started using 2002s in 73. You can see clearly in The Song Remains the Same, he's playing 2002 Crashes, and I believe the hats are, they look like 2002s.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But the ride is not a 2002. And I think a lot of people make that mistake that they think he had all 2002s. In 73, and then The Song Remains the Same, and in Earl's Court in 75. He had a giant beat ride still. He seemed to prefer, he obviously preferred a giant beat 24.
Yeah, and the bell, cuff is a lot bigger on the giant
beat. You don't see the 2002 24 until the steel kit.
Yeah, until 77.
Yeah, gotcha. And that was all, then it was all 2002s. But I think sometimes he had a 602 over on the far right.
A 20-inch medium ride he'd use as a crash.
Yeah. Yeah. So he had two up above the floor tom.
I think that document, Marcel Vogelman got that Pisces document that shows when Bonham got his cymbals. I think it's incomplete. You can see some pictures from 72 where he has two crashes on his left. And you can see, I think the 18 is a giant beat, but the 16 he's hitting on the underside, you can see the word Peisty, which
that's a 2002. That's on the list, though. That's on the
actually,
list.
Actually, you know, believe it or not, the first 2002 that list shows Bonham getting is a 16 inch medium in February of 73.
Exactly. And that's when he's playing it.
But yes, but isn't there a picture from 72? That shows him some pictures from 72 that show him with that cymbal? Or is that just early 73 on the European tour?
I don't think so. I thought it was early 73 in Europe.
Let me look at that.
We have to go back and look, but you know, that corresponds to those dates in Europe.
But here's the thing. It doesn't show him getting any more 2002s till after the American tour.
Right. Right, and he's clearly playing 2002s on The Song Remains the Same.
So that
list is not, you know,
complete or
not. He might have called and said, "Let me get throw this on there too," or something, or
yeah, or just bought them, you know. Yeah, but anyway, it is. Yeah, so the cymbals. Yeah, you know how it is. We just need. We need to just get Jason Bonham to open up to somebody about all the gear.
Raises the question, and you were joking, Terry, saying, "Oh, I need to talk to him." No, one of you guys need to talk to him, because even talking to you two, I'm like, I'm glad I could get you guys together for this. But like, really, you guys know so much. It's like just letting, you know, kind of prompting you and letting you guys go at it. You need an absolute. If Jason would be involved in anything, it absolutely needs to be with someone who I love. Zeppelin. I've loved them my entire life, but you guys are on a whole nother level of expertise and knowledge. I mean, I reached out to his people, his like through his website, his agent, you know, agency or whatever. And they said, maybe in the future, you guys definitely need to try and get that set up. I know that would be your dream, because he probably holds a lot of secrets that people want to know. Am I right?
Oh yeah. I would think definitely. I just wonder if how much of that is privacy. Like he wants to keep some things private, you know,
sure,
which is understandable. Yeah. And then I've heard from someone, you know, the older I get, the less I can connect what I heard to the actual source.
Yeah, yeah.
But somebody said there's just not that much that Jason told him. Like, there's just not that much left.
Yeah.
You know, some things have been auctioned off. Some things were lost in the shuffle, maybe.
Who was the other fellow we talked to? Someone else we talked to said that some stuff was stolen years ago out of a Zeppelin, like, storage unit.
I don't remember, but I'd heard that too.
Yeah, it came from, I think, Deb Bottom. Wait,
did Deborah Bottom say?
Is Deborah's his sister and Zoe's his daughter?
Yes.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Yeah. One of Zoe or Debbie or Deborah took lessons from somebody.
Zoe.
Yeah, Zoe. And he asked her
about that. That's the source.
Yeah, that's the source, yeah.
Who was that? Do you remember who?
I think it's the fellow, the DM-190. Remember we did that interview with the drum man, right. 190 guys?
Right. Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good dudes. Right. Yeah, one of the fellas on there had taught her, you know, had given her some lessons.
And she said, you know, a lot of my dad's stuff is just, it was stolen or just disappeared.
Yeah.
Terrible.
So.
But, you know, I mean, but it is cool. You know what I mean? Like, we've been trying. George and I have the committee. It's housed in the what's the building that got broken into? The Watergate building. It's the committee. It's the committee to try and get the committee. The outtakes from The Song Remains the Same, where you just like you know, a guy, camera guy, you know, just anything. Maybe if there's any sound. It's like over Bonham's shoulder, and he's like, you know,
totally.
Just anything. Give us any footage with Bonham.
Treasure trove.
I mean, it's got to be out there.
Anything. You look at like the Get Back stuff with like the Beatles and Peter Jackson putting it together. You need some kind. I mean, who knows what could happen down the
road?
Can
you imagine?
All this stuff just comes out.
When I saw the Get Back film, I was thinking, wow, Glyn Johns was just in the studio a few months earlier with Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Because wasn't that January of 69?
Yeah.
Get Back?
Yeah.
So then in October of 68, he recorded the first album.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, and how cool.
Maybe someday.
And then you hear a couple times John Lennon, who could be a little acerbic, is sort of like, hey, Glynis, start the tape machine. Because there was an actress in England named Glynis Johns.
Glynis Johns. Funny. Yeah.
So wow. Glynn would be like, like there's that scene in the guys are recording. What's the one? The Stones. Please allow me.
And
they're sitting there, and Keith Richard and Mick Jagger and Brian Jones are sitting there kind of working something out, and Glyn John kind of walks up and he goes, I'd like to get some levels, and Keith Richard goes, not now.
Just like, geez, easy.
That's it. And Glyn John just kind of goes like.
Just walks away.
Just goes, not now.
Wow. They're the stars, you know.
Maybe at some point some photos will surface from some of these sessions.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fellow Bonham maniacs who are really into this and into the knowing about the gear used on specific albums and stuff. I mean, live we pretty much know because there's a lot of photographs of them live and there's footage. But in the studio, it would be really interesting to see what he was playing.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know? Wouldn't it be funny? A picture's going to turn up from Stargroves. There's going to be like a freaking 2012-14 freaking Rodgers kit, and it'll be hanging
I mean,
me and George.
You never know. You know when that auction was the auction.
Like,
for
you
the
gotta
Black
know what the hell you're talking about.
So we'll have to redo the video
from jail. Yeah. Like
the auction of the Black Diamond Pearl kit.
Yeah,
there was a comment in there that said drums that were played by John Bonham on When the Levee Breaks. Like there was this statement that just like, this is the kit he used. So at first I was like, what, you know, that's total BS. But then I was like, well, how do I know?
There's no
photos.
Yeah.
What if that was the kit that Bonham remembered that kit and was like, hey, I want to use this kit for a couple tunes.
Yeah. You never know.
And Robert Plant might have been the one who said, this is the drums, mate, that Bonham played.
Yeah, right.
You know,
that's true. Yeah. See, that's
on
true.
When the Levee Breaks. And that, I don't know. Whoever that person was, that was doing the auction. You can look at it. If you Google John Bonham, Black Diamond, Pearl, and then auction, you'll find it. And you'll see pictures of plants standing behind the kit like this.
Wow.
You know? Fascinating. I mean, so it's legit. It's legit.
Yeah. Oh man, it's easy to run away with the speculation, but I like how George you said that it's you got to stick with it, and this is factual, true stuff. It's unbelievable. Hopefully, more stuff turns up. This has been awesome. I guess the last question I would have, gear wise, what sticks would he have been using?
Terry has them.
There you go.
Well, I have right here in my possession. These are what I call the Bonzillium 2A.
They just happen to be for sale.
Oh, there we go.
No, but what these are essentially more or less, these are based on the Ludwig 2A of yore that Bonham really, really supposedly loved. You know, and okay. It has a nice taper and stuff. But, yep. You know, we talked about, I mean, there was a Pruco stick he liked. There was supposedly a Premier stick maybe he liked. There were some sticks that look to be Ludwigs, but they don't look like 2As or 2Bs. They look like something else. They look thicker, but the beads just look a little bigger.
This is a pair of Dino Danelli 2A Ludwig. Now, I have other pairs of 2A Ludwig, not Dino Danelli's signature, from a little earlier than this. I think these are more mid-70s, mid-late 70s.
Bigger beads,
I have some 2As from the early 70s. And they look more like Terry's reproduction stick.
Yeah.
This bead is different. Do you see this bead? It's a little bit more like an acorn.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
The 2A bead is a little bit more of a capsule.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
So I think the Dino Danelli stick is slightly different than the conventional stock Ludwig 2A.
I actually prefer it, actually. I like the beads a little bigger.
And do you see the taper here in the neck before you get to the bead? It's very thin.
Yeah, yeah.
So my gut feeling is Bonzo went through a lot of these on a gig.
Sure.
I think they're thinner than yours, Terry.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They're very thin. I mean, these crack. If I made a video with these, this pair would probably be cracked by the end of the video.
Yeah.
I mean, they last maybe a few tunes.
Funny thing is these sticks I had, this fella in Wisconsin, Leroy from Lewis, that they're very, very durable, and the finish is very anti-slip. You know, I'd always heard the 2A or the 2B. I made those because I thought they'd be cool. It's a stick I haven't seen for a long time.
Yeah, totally.
What's interesting is there's a photo of Robert Plant at a sound check from 75. It was the first day.
Oh, behind the drums.
Behind the drums. He's sitting behind the drums. And I think right around that time was when he started getting the Pramuco custom stick, his own stick.
Yeah.
So I find it interesting that up until then, he didn't have his own stick as one of the top rock drummers in the world.
Yeah, really.
He was using Dino Danelli sticks or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And eventually he had this guy. What's the guy's name from Pramuco? He created these custom sticks for many rock drummers in England, Cozy Powell and Mitch Mitchell, and you know, a lot of guys were using his custom sticks. And Bonzo's Pramuco sticks they made a recent issue of the John Bonham Pramuco stick, but it's not the same.
Yeah,
it's not
sure.
It's a similar length and width, but the bead is different and the taper is different. And you know, that's unfortunate to me because I really wish they would have just made the replica stick.
Just do it exactly.
Yeah, but they didn't.
Yeah.
You know, who knows if Pramuco is even the same Pramuco? They might have got bought by some other company and they just slapped John Bonham's name on it, you know.
Well, the funny thing with the Pramuco is they do make sticks, but the sticks are they're kind of lower quality generally. Like they seem like the sticks you get with an entry-level snare drum and stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Like, you know? But the Pramuco John Bonham signature that they did come out with a few years ago, they are a high quality hickory stick. And it's a nice playing stick. I actually think it's a really nice stick. It's almost like a regular sort of 5A, everybody's sort of 5A, but with sort of the shaft that goes from under the bead to the stick, which is a little more like the original Bonham Pramuco. Like that's similar. Like in the bottom Pramuco, it like tapers like this almost perfectly straight and then goes to the stick.
And then cuts. Yeah. And then but cuts. The bead is really different.
The bead is like a 5A nowadays, but the original Pramuco was a little different.
Well, that's interesting. So, but like you said, with everything, that he probably just burned through them. And if he had sticks sitting around, like he probably tried a bunch of stuff and he probably played tons of different sticks just because there's sticks. You break them and you.
Well, and I think once he. Yeah, there they are. I think once he got the Promuco.
See that big.
Yeah, that's like a Vic Firth bead.
Yeah, that is.
That's like a Vic Firth bead. That's not. It's a Christmas
instead
tree.
Of it being more tapered.
Yeah, but yeah, Bonzo, kind of like the.
His were kind of like an olive seed. You know. Sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But, you know, I think his tech, Mick Hinton, said they had like a, what do you call it, a gross?
Yeah, a gross 144 of sticks. Pair.
144 gross of sticks. He said there was always a gross of sticks right off to his side, you know.
Wow.
Because I'm sure, I mean, if he was playing these, they must have been, tips must have been flying off.
Yeah. Do those appear to be hickory, or do you think that they're... Maple?
Oh, these are hickory.
They are. Okay.
Cool.
Yeah. So,
well, that sticks. I mean, I think there's so much, and we will maybe down the road. I feel like his recording and the mic techniques is an entire other conversation, which could go on for a long time. But for the sake of now, as we wrap up here, I think this has been awesome. I think you know, if you're listening to this on as a podcast. There has been photos inserted the whole time. So when they're referring to something, there's gonna be a photo on the screen, which you would have seen if you're watching on YouTube. But be sure to, I'll put the link for the YouTube video in the description of the audio format. So if you are listening, go ahead and if you want to hear it again, an hour and 40 minutes of us talking about Zeppelin, mainly these two talking about Zeppelin, then do that. But as we wrap up, is there anything you guys want to, maybe promote your own channels and all that stuff. Whoever wants to go first, you know, tell them about where they can find you.
This is the George Flutus PFOZ apparel wear with this phallus on
the front. It's a little hard to make that out.
Blimp, 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 blimp.
Looks like Moby Dick.
Yeah. That's funny.
Moby's what? Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, so George, of course, has PFOZ. He's got Bonomology's channel. I have the Bonzolium channel. I'm doing that new music with my friend Ty Vare, who's singing with PFOZ. He's doing the Zeppelin bits there, the cool. Robert Plant vocals, which is amazing. That stuff is, I don't know how these guys do it. There should be like a documentary on the making of PFOZ stuff. I'm serious. The way you guys put it together.
PFOZ is People's Front of Zeppelin. It's a silly name for a really good cover band, virtual Zeppelin tribute we do on YouTube. So it's a YouTube channel, People's Front of Zeppelin. And we don't play in the same room together ever, although one day we hope to do that. you know, it's like a virtual band thing.
Yeah.
And I have a drum sample pack and loops that came out recently through Yurt Rock, which is a really great organization that has featured a lot of top tier drummers. You know, playing their own beats and for loops and samples, and mine is under the name Bonomology. So it's basically Bonham-esque, you know, style.
Sure.
Drum beats for looping and sampling. So awesome. You can check that out at Yurt Rock. And I'm
Yurt.
Just, you know, Yurt, Y-U-R-T.
Yep.
Rock.
Yeah. Love a good Yurt.
Yeah. Good Yurt.
Good Yurt. Yes.
And then there's Teepee Rock.
yeah.
No, it's not Yurt available at TP Rock.
Yurt Rock stuff is awesome.
yes.
I will
yes,
put sure. links to all the description. Obviously, Bonzolium, Terry, your stuff is awesome as well. Both of you guys have your videos and your channels are just like, it never, anyone that I put on, either of you guys, it is always just fascinating. And I'm like, I love Bonham. You can go from being, you know, little bit interested to Bonham to someone who's kind of like a history nerd who really likes Bonham, but you guys are obviously next level to the master bonzo like freaks, as we'll say in a good way.
I don't know how this happened.
What you guys do is just incredible. So check the description for everyone who's listening or watching to see. I mean, most people know you guys. If you're listening to this and you're an hour and 50 minutes into it, you've probably heard what George and Terry are doing.
Has it been that long? Wow. It just flew by.
It did. And it'll be a little shorter because we'll clean stuff up. But
that's good.
Before we end, though, I do want to give a shout out to, I hope I say his name right, Stefano Ashbridge, who joined up with the Drum History Podcast Patreon at a certain level, which is $15 a month, where he gets a shout out. So thank you to Stefano. And actually, his brand is drumlessonsinla.com.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Nice. Check out drumlessonsinla.com. And because he's at that tier, he gets now his name at the end of all the YouTube videos, which I always say to people, that's a very cheap way to advertise your brand, is to do Patreon at that level. You get your name. There's six or seven
cool
on there. And nice. Lots of different people have been doing it with drum brands and shops and podcasts and stuff.
Nice.
So thank you to Stefano for doing that. It really helps support the show. And on that note, gentlemen, thank you for taking the time and joining me back on and giving me all your Bonham. Again, I feel like you guys, I kind of let you talk most of the time because it's as a Bonham fan, but, you know, it's hard to add information that you guys don't know or to bring something up because you guys know so much.
Well,
it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it always helps and feels good, though, to get questions, you know.
Sure.
To stimulate the conversation. So
otherwise, you guys are just talking at each other about Bonham.
Yeah. So it's really enjoyable to do this. And
yes,
you know.
No, the pleasure is all mine. Yep. Yeah. Cool. Well, this is awesome. So thank you guys for being here and sharing photos and everything that's been throughout the video with me. And cool. Hopefully we'll all be able to hang out at a future like Chicago drum show or something like that.
You're in Cincy, right? Cincinnati?
I'm in Cincy. Yep.
That's nice, okay.
That would be great. I'll hit you up if I'm coming to Cincy.
Yeah, for sure. Please do.
Cool.
Yeah.
Right.
Awesome. Thank you, fellas.
Bart,
I appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Thanks
so much
again, Bart.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning.